everyone, and welcome to the Time Shifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher, and for the time being, I'm all alone. That won't last, though, as I'm here by myself to introduce a fantastic interview I did with friend and independent filmmaker Henrik Kudo. Before we get into that, though, the usual stuff. If you're listening for the first time, welcome. Make sure you subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, or Google Play. And please, if you like what you hear, rate and review us at any of those locations. It does help. We have a Facebook group that you can join, and there you can participate in any number of discussions that have popped up over various topics and news stories. Just search for Time Shifters Podcast. Is Twitter your thing? Follow us at Time Shifters Pod, and you can follow my usual co-host, Matt, at Movies at the Matt. Maybe you'd like to send us an old-fashioned email. Fire those off to timeshifterspodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to type it out, or if you like, record a message with your phone or computer and send it along. However you choose to get in touch, we'd love to hear from you. All right, now back to Henrik Kudo. Over the years, I've reported on, shared with you, and reviewed the films of Mr. Kudo. Since the 2012 film Babysitter Massacre, I've watched with fascination as he churns out one film after another, continually growing and experimenting as a filmmaker. It's been a blast following his life and career. This sit-down with Henrik was long overdue, and I'm thrilled we finally made it happen. This discussion is packed with a little bit of everything, from his earliest days in filmmaking to his most recent and secretive future projects, which he gave me a couple peeks at, and I am excited at what is to come. I can't say anything, as I've been sworn to secrecy, but trust me, it's really, really awesome. All right, that's enough from just me, so let's jump back in time to the home office of Henrik Kudo. All right, folks, well, future Christopher has certainly given you a nice intro here, so I will go ahead and just tell you I'm sitting across from Henrik Kudo, and I'm thrilled to do this. I don't know why I have not done this sooner.
Well, you know, there's this, I do know that there's this aura of severe, insatiable busyness around me that often makes people, like, not think to reach out. So.
Well, you know, and I have, you know, I've been to a couple of your screenings, and I've brought the recorder thinking, oh, maybe I just get him for, a, you know, 5-10 minutes or something, but no.
Those are impossible. Yeah.
You're a busy man. Now, this is awesome. I didn't know this. I looked up to say, oh, when was it that we met? Because we met because of the 2012 B-Movie Celebration.
Yes.
And it turns out the day that we're recording this is actually the anniversary of us becoming Facebook friends.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw it this morning. That is so...
I thought that was
what
funny.
What a coinkydink.
It is a coinkydink. I couldn't believe it. Like, that's awesome. Because I think we became Facebook friends just like a week or so before the actual celebration.
Yeah, yeah. Because we were on the Facebook chat or Facebook group or whatever.
Group.
So
yeah.
I started adding people because I didn't know anybody was going to be there. So, which was good because I think we sat... next to each other for a couple of movies, which is nice, because otherwise I was just the solo guy walking around Columbus, Indiana, looking like a maniac, as I often do.
Felt a little bit like that myself. So it was fun making some new friends while I was up there and bumping into people that I'd only seen online, and I thought it was really cool. That was a good time, and it was a fun...
It was.
You didn't have any films showing that year.
No. That was right before my career went berserk. Mm-hmm. I think... Because if that was 2012, that means that I was probably September of 2012. That means that I had not begun shooting Babysitter Massacre yet. Mm-hmm. So I had just wrapped Depression the movie, and it had either just premiered or was about to premiere. If it was September of 2012, then it was about to premiere or had just premiered. And that was my fourth feature. Mm-hmm. And I'm on feature 16 now, so
bit
you know,
busy man.
It was and that was 5 years ago. So it's like that was right because once I did Babysitter Massacre, I never stopped working. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went right into A Bulldog for Christmas, Haunted House in Sortie Row, Awkward Thanksgiving, Scarewaves, Alone in the Ghost House, Calamity Jane's Revenge, Making Out, Amityville No Escape. I could
go on and on.
That was right before. So that's I think had it been. The next year, I might have had something. I think the following year, I almost had something screened, but something came up where it – because that's the thing is everything gets tied up with distributors, and it gets tied up with whoever rightfully owns the movie, depending on which movie it is. That's one of the interesting things. I've been putting out a lot of physical media recently. I've kind of had like a resurgence with Blu-ray DVD combos and stuff. And people are like, when's this coming out? And I'm like, well, I don't own that. And they're like, well, you don't own this? And I'm like, no, I own that. Like, well, how do I know? And I'm like, you just got to ask.
Just ask and you'll see what I got.
Some of my own, some of my don't. I own slightly more than 50% of my output, but not much more.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, it is what it is. You know, I mean, I built a career on selling movies to distributors and producers. So yeah, it's always kind of tricky to do like film festival screenings and stuff.
This is a great way. You kind of jumped ahead and talked about a lot of your projects that you had just recently and everything, but I want to go back a little bit because this is one of the fun things that I love. You know, it's always fun talking to the actors and stuff, the people in front of the camera. I really enjoy talking to people behind the cameras, the producers, the directors, the writers, you know, the real brains of the operation kind of thing. And you are everything. Actually, you're all four. You're a writer, director, producer. You've acted, you have appeared in and everything. But this is the coolest thing is when you really began, you were a backyard filmmaker.
I mean, straight up backyard. Like, yeah. Literally the backyard of this very house.
Right.
This house was purchased by my mother and now I rent it. And so I still see that backyard pretty regularly. Yeah, I mean, if you want me to go all the way to the beginning, I came from humble beginnings, very humble beginnings. So we didn't have a lot to go around, and all I wanted in the entire world was a camcorder, like so bad. And I wanted that Nickelodeon camcorder. I don't know if you remember that one. The Nickelodeon marketed a camcorder and it was black and white and it had to be plugged into your VCR. But it was super cheap because of those elements. Kind of like the whatever it was called, like the ClicoCam or whatever, the one that shot that filmed on cassette tapes and it was in black and white and it looked terrible. It was kind of like that, except it was detached. And I remember the viewfinder didn't see through the lens. It was actually just clear, like you could just see straight through it, kind of like a point and shoot camera. Uh-huh. I wanted one of those so bad, and my mother thought that it looked like a piece of crap, so my mom wouldn't get me one, even though it was the cheapest camera there was. And, I mean, whatever. So, fast forward a few years later, life starts to get better, and then my mother buys this house, and a few years in, my mother took out a small second mortgage to get storm windows put on the house. And there was just enough money left over that we put a VHS camcorder in layaway.
Remember that,
Walmart.
Folks? Layaway. Nice.
And we just I remember very clearly the day that mom was like she calls me Ricky. She was like, Ricky, we're going to Walmart. We're picking up that camcorder. And I was like, and I was about 11 or 12, maybe like just about to turn 12.
Oh wow!
So before that, I would do. Like radio skits on my mom had like a voice, you know, tape recorder. And I had a talk boy like from Home Alone 2.
Oh, okay.
I used to do skits and stuff like that. But all I wanted in the world was a video camera. So I get the video camera and I went full size VHS for those super nerds. I didn't go VHS-C. I didn't go high eight. I went full size VHS because I wanted to be able to like shoot stuff and then immediately stick it into the VCR and watch
see
it.
See what you did. Yeah.
And so. And around that exact same time, I was sitting at home watching cable. And in this area of Dayton, Ohio, Channel 23 at that time was CATV, Community Access Television South. And on there was a live call-in show called Opening Night Theater. It was hosted by local filmmaker Andrew Kopp. He was the host. And I called into that show a few times because it was an improv comedy show. So you could call in and give them your thoughts or whatever. But they ran these PSAs, these little commercials in between that were like, if you want to make your own TV show, call 438-8887 and, you can be your own whatever. So I called that number first thing the next morning and it was this little kid just, is there an age requirement to take the class? and they were like, no. And I was like, thank you. And I like hung up and I called my mom. And I was like, mom, there's no requirement. So I was the youngest person at that time to take the class, and I was the youngest person to ever, I mean, it may have changed now because it's been forever since I've been over there, but I was the youngest person to ever have their own show without an adult, producing
not
it or working on it.
You actually being the
host
or the star.
I was the producer and the director and the editor, and I did all of that myself. Now, it was horrible. it was not good. And what better place for a child's experiments in video than completely on cable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I got so many mean emails because I put my email address on it. Because why wouldn't you?
Sure.
I also made a lot of friends. I have friends to this day that I made because they emailed my TV show when I was 12 years old, 13, 12 years old. So I did two shows. I did and I worked on like tons of shows. That was like the first time I ever found like community. Because what you did is you would go there, you would learn how to operate the cameras, you'd learn how to operate the decks and everything. And then you would hear like, oh, so-and-so's doing a show on Saturday. And you'd come in and you'd crew for them. And then they'd crew for you. And it was a really cool symbiotic kind of thing. And you made like lots of really cool friends, which made all of my friends when I was 12, 13, they were all in their 20s because I was the youngest one doing it. Because all the other shows that were kids, like kids produced shows, their parents were a producer or whatever. And I didn't have that at all. So, which was one of the reasons I'm sure that my shows were so rough around the edges, but I had a variety show called, brace yourself, the Henrik Kudo Show. And cause we were a television station. So record companies would send us 3/4-inch tapes of music videos they wanted promoted. So I would literally just raid the tape shelves and I would intro, you know, here's this music video and it would play, and then here's this and then it would play. I would make skits and I'd play those. I made a music video of my mom's poodle. I did all kinds of those things, and I did probably like 5 or 6 episodes of it through, whenever I could. Right. I basically lived there. My mother would drop me off on Saturday and Sunday every weekend, and I would edit there, or I would
get you out of trouble.
It really did. And Andrew Kopp was there. He worked there. He was actually, I think you would have called him the community coordinator. So he was the guy you would go to if you were like, we weren't editing on computers. This was SVHS deck. SVHS deck. This was right before computer editing became affordable. So, I'd be like, it's just black. I hit play and it's just black, and he'd come in and he hit 3 buttons and be like, there you go. I would end up just hanging out with him and, being a little brother type. And, cause he was a filmmaker, and he would talk about movies and stuff like that. So it became like my place to hang. I mean, my mom would literally drop me off at 10 a.m. with like $6, because whoever worked there, I would catch one of them if they were going to go get lunch, and I'd give them $6 and they'd get me Arby's as well. It was literally, go forth, because I think they were open like 10 to 6, Friday and Saturday and Sunday. So you could do work on your shows. And then the other show I did was Cult Theater, which was a horror host show. Oh, okay. And I was at that time the world's youngest horror host, because I was 13 years old hosting Zombie 4 After Death and Night of the Living Dead and I Bury the Living. And I did like 4 or 5 or 6 episodes of those. A lot of those are totally lost to the ether, and rightfully so.
So. Were you kind of the Elvira stuff, kind of break in during the
We tried on the
instead first... of a commercial break, there was a Kudo break.
Exactly. We tried on the first episode doing like MST3K, but we weren't. I'm a child. I didn't sit and write jokes and stuff. We would just try to and it would crash and burn.
Yes. As most people who try to do that, just little throwing that out there, folks.
It's hard to riff on a movie.
It is.
And do it well and often. So, so we'd pop into the movie maybe 3 or 4 times, and just, do skits or comedy or whatever. And, it was a lot of fun. And that was like my entire childhood. My late childhood was there. And then when I turned 15, there were some incidents with, I don't want to say censorship because that's a little bit too strong of a term, but like there were incidents where like people's shows, my friends' shows were getting pulled and stuff because of content, which was not supposed to happen. Because the entire point of community access television, is that it's on cable. The idea is that cable channels, I worked in community access after that. I had a day job in it for a little while. The entire idea is that the reason you access cable is because cable uses infrastructure from the city.
Right.
Therefore, it becomes a free speech. That's kind of a trade-off. It's a free speech option. So you get to do your cable access. And that's what you – because you pay a franchise fee. And that allots you to have your own voice on cable access. So it's supposed to be a free speech safe haven. And they're not supposed to be allowed to tell you you can't do anything. Now, they can tell you, like, your show's whatever. It's showing after 11 p.m.
Right.
But that's it. They called it safe harbor hours, like after 11 or 12. I mean, and there were people for a while there showing borderline pornography and stuff late at night, and there was nothing that could be done. It's cable.
Yeah.
You know? The most famous example in America of that is Midnight Blue, which was Al Goldstein, the Screw magazine publisher.
Okay.
He did Midnight Blue, which was on at midnight on New York cable access, and it literally, I mean, it was nakedness and pornography and whatever he wanted, and also his incredibly, incredibly, incredibly offensive viewpoint of the world, and him, you know, offering money to kill the Ayatollah, and I mean, doing things that got him investigated by the FBI, but he did it all on safe harbor hours, and no one could do anything to stop his show.
Interesting. I did not know about that aspect of the...
Oh, yeah. Now, that has taken a huge dive over the last few years, but the good news is we have YouTube, although they're starting to also censor people. But, you know, but they're a private company and they have every right. I mean, there was a time before my time when the community access centers around here, like they had white supremacists would do shows and they had to let them. You just had to.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times when people would show really offensive things and you had to let them. And they still do overall. The Safe Harbor Hours still mostly exist. I think they draw the line at actual pornography is the line right now. And I remember when I worked in community access, I was always very upset with the executive director when he would say, like, the line is drawn at pornography. And I'd be like, pornography is the epitome of free speech, sir. Can't imagine why I got fired.
I know,
right?
So weird.
Weird. But no, so, but it got to a point where, I didn't really want to do the shows anymore. I still worked on my friends' shows up until, until I left the state. I still worked on friends' shows, but I started making movies in the backyard. Mm-hmm. And that is when it really started to get crazy. Cause I would crank them out like crazy. Not to make a sales point, but, I just put out the Backyard Legacy, the ultimate edition of my backyard.
Kind of where I was going with the whole thing anyway. Yeah.
Well, it really is over 6 hours of these backyard movies. Some of them are 20 minutes, some are 40 minutes, some of them are 10 minutes. I mean, they really vary. But like over the course of 3 or 4 years, I cranked out like 12 of them, you know, just boom, 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 boom. And, you know, not much has changed. but I mean, I would crank them out and I would. But the big difference is that I would this was, you know, when AOL Instant Messenger was the thing.
Right.
And I'd made friends through chat rooms and stuff like that. So I had a friend over the internet who knew Photoshop, which I didn't. So he would make me DVD covers. So nice. I'd make a crummy movie in my backyard with my friends. I'd edit it in my bedroom on a Macintosh that cost so much money. Now it's crazy. Like, you're in my office right now. And like, this machine, this incredibly nice Macintosh, it cost like $400 less than my first one that was crappy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is nicest one you can get.
No, I understand. No, I grew up in the same time, or even a little bit before then, where, you know, the first Mac you brought home was probably $5,000-$10,000, some of them, you know, and it came with like 2 megabytes of RAM and
My first was an eMac G4 because the educational Mac, not the iMac, the eMac,
right?
Because it was a little bit cheaper and that was like $3,400. It was crazy. I couldn't believe when my mother was like, you know, I think we can swing it. I had to pay her a little bit back on that. But luckily I've always been industrious and I started doing DVD authoring and stuff for money, so I was actually making some dough with
good
it. But what I would do is I'd have sleeves printed, super cheap, and then I would go to Blockbuster and I would dumpster dive the cases, the DVD cases.
Oh, sure.
Because they'd swap them out with their Blockbuster cases, which makes sense because the Blockbuster cases were way sturdier, way nicer. Because if you ever bought a movie used at Blockbuster, you'd notice it was in that that hard case.
I used to work there.
Then you totally know exactly what I'm talking about. So I would pull completely fine DVD cases out of the dumpster from Blockbuster, and then I'd burn the DVDs, and I'd learn to author. So I was a 15-year-old kid, and I would sell a movie on DVD that I shot in my backyard, but it had commentary and extras and trailers, and it was programmed like a professional thing. And I owe that to I owe that to J.R. Bookwalter, the filmmaker who did The Dead Next Door and a ton of other movies. J.R. Bookwalter kind of over the internet took me under his wing and was like, here's what you, if you're on Mac, here's what you need. You know, he'd be like, get yourself DVD Studio Pro, learn how to use it, you know, and all the stuff. He was a very good guy, still is, I mean, but he was a huge help. So, yeah, you'd buy these movies and That was the way it was. So I would then take them to conventions, and literally I would go to a convention if I was offered a fourth of the table, and I would put my little backyard movies that had cover boxes and everything, and I would sell them and I would mm-hmm. hawk them. And that was really the beginning of what has become a career. But I would literally, you know, I'd sleep under the Macintosh, so I'd hear the ding, and I'd wake up and I'd change the discs because I had to burn all the discs one by one.
One drive,
by one.
Yes.
Oh, and that was when burning a DVD took 45 minutes.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So,
I remember.
Yeah, one by one by one. And every single one that I got burned, I was like, okay, this is a potential another $10. So mm-hmm. I got to keep burning them. And I'd be sitting up at night, you know, with scissors cutting out all the sleeves. And it was just... It was, you know, but it's funny because I look back now, I used to laugh at that, and then people would, I would tell people about it now, and they'd be like, that sounds exactly like how you start a business.
Yeah.
Like you just, do whatever it takes, and you suffer through it.
Exactly.
But I remember I used to go to high school, and I had two Trapper Keepers, because you couldn't carry a backpack. This is after Columbine. So you couldn't carry a backpack between classes. So I had carried two Trapper Keepers, one that had school stuff in it, and the other was full of DVDs. And I would sell them in class. Oh, yeah. Until I was told twice to stop by the faculty. And that was when I was like, why am I even here if I can't sell them? So I dropped out.
Oh, my God.
So I dropped out when I was 16. And that's – it just kind of kept going from there, because then I was like, all I want to do is make these movies and sell them. That's all I want.
Well, it's a lot of drive. I mean, obviously, you have the drive, and what you described is just an example. You know, look up the drive in the dictionary. But I actually was really curious to even go a little further back. Is why did you want to make these movies? I mean, there had to have been, you know, what was the inspiration? What was the film? What was the filmmaker?
Sure.
You know, what was it that really said, that's what I want to do?
Well, and that's a great question, because that's an interesting one, because I'm still learning it. You know, I'm a man of 31 years. Of age. So, you know, I'm looking back 15, 16, 17, 18 right. years, you know.
Well, especially because when you started doing this, you were so young.
Incredibly young.
A preteen or, you know, a tween or a preteen when you started. So I'm very curious to know what started the drive.
Well, and the funny thing, just a really quick side note, is my mother had came from extremely humble beginnings and worked from the time she was 12, 13 years old. So when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, and I'd be like, I want to get a job so I can have money, my mom would be like, what do you want? Like, what money do you want? Because my mother's made an incredible life for herself, and she's my entire inspiration. But she'd be like, well, what do you want? Like, if you want a bike, like, how about I just buy you a bike and you be a kid? Because my mom hated the idea of me working young,
right?
Because she had to. And she was like, you don't have to. So what do you want? Like, let's see if we can just do it, you know? So that's the extra funny thing about the drive and desire to work and the desire to, like, go out and hustle was completely not encouraged. It was like, no, like, play.
Mom was trying to
go
stifle
play.
It. And...
Not stifle, but yeah.
Too
but
strong
she was,
a word.
She was,
yeah.
Well, stifle would be too strong a word. She didn't – she was afraid that I felt I had to.
Gotcha.
Especially, I think, because we were really humble in the beginning, and I think that she was worried that insecurity – you know, financial insecurity was instilled in me.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, so when I would say I wanted to go work, she'd be like, but you don't have to. Like, what, you want a DVD? Let's go to Best Buy. I'll just buy a DVD. Like, what you want? Right. You want a camcorder? Let's go. Like, you know, she couldn't just drop that kind of money, but you know, eventually she could.
Well,
you know,
like a lot of parents, really nice or life. Like most parents, I think she wanted a better life than
exactly.
she had for her son.
Exactly.
Yes,
so
I completely understand that.
Yeah. So that being said, you know, my mother, super hard worker. And when I was really young, I think this will tie into your question relatively well. When I was really young, my mother had me at 32, I believe, 31 or 32. So, you know, a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really trying to make a good life, you know, not make a living, but make a life.
Right.
And so she would do whatever it takes. She sold patio. She did those. Remember patio furniture parties and stuff where you would like go to a house and they'd show you all the stuff and try to sell it to you? My mother did patio furniture
I didn't know there was patio furniture parties.
And
it sounds
Tupperware
just,
parties.
Yeah, the same thing as like Tupperware
and
or
Mary Kay. She did Mary Kay.
What's the cooking one? There's the Pampered Chef.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
She did those kinds of things and was relatively successful. She was very good at selling Mary Kay cosmetics. And then she would also worked her, she had a job at a major corporation in town. But it was it was entry level, but she's all the way to managing a ton of people now.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you know, she would do that and she studied at night and she would work at the mall at night. So, you know, my earliest memories are my mother getting off work at 5, picking me up, taking me to the babysitter, and then working 6 to 10 at the mall. So I have all these memories that people would think would be sad, but they're actually really happy memories. I have all these happy memories of, like, falling asleep watching Alfred Hitchcock Presents on Nick at Night, and then waking up, like, and my mom, like, picking me up and mm-hmm. taking me home and putting me to bed. And I think that that's a part of it, because I had to spend a lot of time alone. I had a sister, but she was much older, 9 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she was between us and her father. So, and my father lived in New Hampshire. So, you know, it was mostly just me and mom most of the time. And I loved television. I loved watching TV. I loved watching movies. So those became my friends, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. And my mother very much encouraged that, you know, she, I don't want to say illegally spliced our cable, but I did end up having, you know, cable in my bedroom. So
I'm gonna go ahead and go out on a limb and say you weren't the only ones that were doing it at the time.
Probably not, but my mother was amazing at it. But so I was watching TV. I had my Aunt Betty, who had satellite TV, which was a big deal then.
Oh,
and
yeah,
she'd tape everything. I still have a copy of Curse of the Puppet Master on the VHS tape my Aunt Betty recorded off of satellite. And my copy of Freddy's Dead was up until I bought it on Blu-ray or on DVD. It was the VHS of my Aunt Betty's handwriting on it. I was always into movies. And as I got older, I wanted to watch more movies. And I can tell you the movie that made me realize movies were movies, if that makes sense. That made mm-hmm. me realize, like, this is a creative thing and somebody had to do this.
And art, and not just entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, for someone. I mean, because I was really young. I was probably 9. One of my favorite movies to watch over and over again, because I watched over and over again Monster Squad, The Lost Boys. But the one I watched the most next to Terminator 2 was Batman, Burton's Batman.
Oh, okay.
And the reason I always go to Burton's Batman is because I would watch Terminator 2 and I would get really into it. I'd watch Lost Boys, I'd get really into it. But there was the scene in Burton's Batman when they destroy all the art and they play on screen. They hit play on the music box and they're destroying the place to Prince.
Right.
But they're literally destroying it to Prince. It's not music on the soundtrack. The characters are aware that they're dancing to Prince and wrecking all the art.
Gives that sort of meta quality to
it. Exactly. And that made me go, wait, this scene is awesome because they're doing it to the music. And that was kind of the first time that I started, like, it started bubbling in my head that, like, that had to have been decided and it was intentional, because before it felt like it all just kind of melded together without intention or whatever.
Where's the magic music coming from and why is it there?
Yeah.
Suddenly here's like, look, there's music and there's a reason for there being music. Mm-hmm.
And you realize there's a creative process.
Yes.
Because it's like, I always remember Pendulette talking about how when he first heard the Beatles and stuff, what changed his entire viewpoint of show business was he heard a bootleg. And he heard the Beatles, like, in their sessions, and he heard them, like, mess up. Mm-hmm. Or he heard them try something different. And he was like, I had always just assumed that they were just so good, they would just walk into the studio and just do it.
Yeah.
And he was like, but no, they have to work at it, because I have to work at it. So wait, I could be in show business, because you don't have to be perfect. And that was kind of that mindset. I was like, wait, if they can dance around to music on a camera, maybe, like, I could point a camera at something and or whatever. So that was the first time I had realized that movies were presentation.
Okay.
You know, I guess is the best
great way to
put it.
Yeah, I like it.
So that was the big moment. And it took me forever to realize that. But every time I would think, every time I envision a scene in my head, I often think about, you know, dun, 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 and them hitting their hands with the paint on the things. And I'm like, oh, yeah, because that was the first time I'd realized, like, music, picture, action, sound, you know, all come mm-hmm. together. So that was a big moment. And then also, you know, so having my mother work so much, and then eventually, though, there was that weird moment when she didn't have to work so much, you know, when all of a sudden her main job was paying pretty well mm-hmm. and we bought a house, which was a big deal. And my mom was around a little bit more, but my mom was also still a young woman. And, you know, so she needed to, you know, go out. She had, you know, she'd have a boyfriend. They should go out. They should do whatever. Right. So then it became even more relevant to hit up Blockbuster, or hit up Hollywood Video, pick up a couple movies. Because mm-hmm. what are you going to do? You're 13 years old. You're old enough. I was a mature 13 years old. I would stay home alone at 13.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Although my mom had me do the thing. where, you know, when the pizza would come, I had to open the door and go, oh, hi, and then turn and go, Mom, the pizza's there. and then like give them money. And my mom was like, don't, because you don't want them to know you're home alone.
Exactly. No, yeah. I understand.
So it's so funny to remember that back. But so like from like maybe even as young as 11, honestly, I can't remember. I mean, the statute of limitations is long gone.
Yes.
So, but I was very young, but I remember I had some of the fondest memories of my childhood were my mom would go out and have a night out and I would have a tape or two from Blockbuster or mm-hmm. Hollywood Video. And, well, if I went to Hollywood Video, that was because my older sister took me. Cause my mom just thought that place was too skanky.
Oh, okay.
She just did. And my mother, I love her. A little bit of a snob. So my mom, I had the Hollywood Video card. Mm-hmm. Like that was in my wallet. Like my mom didn't have a Hollywood Video card, but she would take me to Blockbuster all the time. And I rented every horror tape one by one by one. And then eventually DVDs once we could afford a DVD player.
Right.
But like, yeah. So, then it became like some of my fondest memories were like, you know, we're getting a pizza and watching these movies. And I have such a lucid, vivid memory of like watching Evil Dead for the first time alone in my bedroom in the dark and then not being able to shut up about it at the bus stop the next, you know, that Monday. I could not shut up. I was like, no, but the light bulb fills with blood. And the kids are like, because I didn't have any friends. So they're like, thanks for telling me all about this thing. Thanks. And then I'd be like, oh, and then I'd be like, I'm going to rent Evil Dead 2 this next weekend. And then I'd rent Evil Dead 2 and be like, oh my God, like the blood was spraying out of the wall. You know, I couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
It was so exciting. It was such an exciting time for me. And that was when I was really like, I want a camcorder. I don't know what I want to do with it. You know, that was the thing, is it really grew organically because I would not stop filming. I'd film everything with that camcorder. Everything. Torment my mother. And just, she hated being filmed.
So it was just, you do a lot of filming and you just wait for that something to click while you're doing it going, wait, that was something I could use. Yeah. That's something good. That's something I can play with.
Well, and that's where the drive part comes in, because I would sit in my bedroom on a Saturday. This was before I was at the cable access place.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit alone and I would have my camcorder plugged into the VCR and I would edit. You know, I'd hit play on that and then hit record right when I wanted it.
Right.
You know, and I would like cobble together this mess. It would look terrible. You know, the erase head was all messed up. So you'd see squiggly lines in between every cut. But I'd do that. And to make like a 2-minute music video or a skit would take 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit quietly in my bedroom just doing that. And that was something when I was in cable access and I was supposed to teach editing and I was supposed to teach these things, people would say like, how do you become a really good editor? And I'd be like, well, to tell you the truth, like once I started editing on a computer, I don't think I was even a remotely decent editor until I'd been doing it for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really had to do that. And they'd be like, you know, 2 or 3 years. And I'd be like, I can't teach you obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, I can't teach I can't teach you passion. I can only teach you click this and it does that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to be a great editor, you're just going to have to go suffer and be one. You know, so, and that was the thing though, like when I look back, especially because I doing the Backyard Legacy, I had to look back at like a lot of the stuff I did. There's one 20-minute segment dedicated to when I was cutting things on VHS, and then everything else is the digital time. Mm-hmm. But I remember like just capturing that footage to like pick. I did like a greatest hits, because I wasn't going to make anybody suffer through like an hour long cable access show I did. But I remember just sitting there going like, the amount of time that I put into that, when most kids wanted to ride bikes or whatever,
play the video games.
It didn't hurt that I had no friends.
Mm.
It definitely helped that I had no friends, because I was a very weird kid. I wore a Star Trek uniform to school when I was in elementary school. I wore a Next Gen uniform as many days as my mother would let me in a row before she'd say, I have to clean this. And they'd be like, I don't even think she had to clean it. I think she just wanted me to not wear it so much. Well, you look at your child. He's standing there wearing a Star Trek uniform. And it's like, okay, have fun at school. Yeah, you know, like, good luck.
Try not to get any blood on it this time.
And my mom, you know, I love her to death. And, you know, she would just look at me and be like, is this what you want to do? And I'd be like, yes. And she'd be like, okay. That was her. That was her. I don't know if that came from, she had a bit of an overbearing mother. I don't know if that, you know, kind of encouraged her to really encourage me to be who I wanted to be, or if it was just the fact that my mom is a risk-taking, bold maverick. No matter how much she might not believe that that's the case, but it is. My mom is the ultimate in like question authority. And I mean, like I would get in trouble at school for like wearing Halloween makeup around Halloween, not on Halloween, but around Halloween. And my mother would show up and yell at the staff, at the faculty. She'd yell at them.
What harm is he doing?
That's exactly what she says. She'd be like, my mother stormed in once and was like, my son has to sit at the principal's office next to a pregnant ninth grader in a school where children are buying drugs.
And you're worried about him wearing Halloween makeup.
Yeah, and you're worried about him. You're worried about him. He's your problem? And they'd be like, well, we just want you to, you know, help him clean his face off. And she was like, I'm taking him home. And she would take me home. No joke. She would take me home and, like, get me McDonald's and ice cream and, like, take me to Best Buy and buy me a DVD. Like, she would reward that behavior.
Way to stick it to the man.
In a way. I mean, I don't know if she knew that she was really rewarding that kind of behavior. But to my mother's perspective was, like, my son is not out drinking. My son is not doing drugs.
He's not hurting anybody.
You know, yeah. And my son just loves movies and he's odd.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was like, you know, is that a crime? It shouldn't be a crime. It's not a crime as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I mean, this was an era. I mean, because it's important to point out, this was like 01, 02, 03. This is after Columbine. This is when schools really bullied weird kids because they wanted you to leave.
Mm-hmm.
They did. And my mom didn't want – it broke my mom's heart when I dropped out of school. She really wanted me to get an education. And I could not be bothered. I hated school so much. And one day when I was 16, right at the end of my sophomore year, I just realized, I was like, holy crap. The only reason that I'm sitting here listening to these people is because a bunch of people, the teachers, faculty, staff, that I don't respect and that I don't believe are smart, are telling me this is the only way to live, to like do life. And then I was like, never mind.
I think I got a better way. Yeah.
And I was not a trouble student either. Aside from those little run-ins, which didn't result in detentions. They didn't result in anything. They were, you know, they were mild disciplinary actions.
Right.
Aside from those, you know, I never had a detention. I never had a demerit. I never had anything. I was a very reserved kid, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I was the kid that would show up wearing like crazy clothes, but I was quiet.
Right.
Because I actually was very afraid of, you know, people thinking I was stupid or insulting me. I was a very sensitive child. So, you know, that was the thing. And I mean, I don't think it's worth going into like crazy, but I was relentlessly bullied. I mean, I was relentlessly bullied, shoved into lockers. I had a door opened into my head once, like a heavy wooden door. I don't think that whoever bully did it, I don't think that they thought they were going to like mess me up and hurt me. I think they just thought it was going to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
But they like hurt me and messed me up really bad. So, you know, I would come home, you know, all beat up. And the worst was like kids would spit on me. That was the worst one. They would spit on me in the bus. Like I'd be listening to headphones and I would get off the bus every day and have to clean my backpack with a rag because it was covered in spit. They'd all spit on my back and stuff. And it's like, I get it that, you know, kids bully kids. I don't even hold it against those people. I've actually had bullies write me and apologize.
No.
I had one guy, not all of them.
Sure.
Some of them just don't remember.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them because, you know, there's that whole thing like how it's like you put out that call about let's stop bullying. But like it seems like 90% of people were bullied, but like almost nobody was a bully.
They don't realize that they were bullying. And that's kind of been my experience, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I had going through school, had to deal with, you know, many, many bullies. And now I'm, you know, at least if not friends, I'm like, you know, Facebook digital friends with some of these people. And it's just, I don't think it doesn't click that they were bullying, you know, they were having fun.
Probably also being bullied.
They may have been. That's
the
true.
Big thing is a lot of people don't realize that people who are getting hit down. They then hit down themselves.
Yeah. You don't know where that's coming from. It could be older kids. It could be family. You don't know, but it's often the case.
And I've gotten nice messages where it's been like, you know, I'm sorry, I know we didn't really get along. And I'm like, dude, this is more than enough apology because we were kids. But I got one that was like really heart wrenching to me because it was like he wrote me this really long thing where he was like, I just want you to know how sorry I am. He was like, I remember everything I did, everything I said to you. And he was like, I went home every day to a drunk dad and a mom who was dying. And, you know, and he really opened up to me. He was like, and I want you to know that I've worked really hard to be a good person And I just hope that you can find it in your heart to forgive me. And also was super kind about saying, like, and it's amazing that you make movies for a living. Like, I'm
right.
astonished and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I wrote back and I was like, I can't type while crying, but
yeah.
thank you so
yeah.
much for
no,
sharing
that's amazing.
Your beautiful story.
Yeah, I mean, we're not to keep, you know, going down rabbit holes or anything here, but I mean, that's somebody that obviously he had emotions
yeah.
and he needed an outlet. And as a kid, you don't know how to focus that kind of stuff.
No.
And so you go for what kids do. You go, you know, oh, I can push him into a locker to, you know, let off steam. So that's, oh, I'll do that.
Yeah.
And, oh, someone thought that was funny. And so,
well, and especially
you understand,
when the only
yeah.
example you see is your parents doing that.
Right.
Then that's what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a strong belief that that hurt people hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever someone is hurtful, I usually try my best to pity them. And feel bad for them and be like, there's no way that you wake up every day and go, man, life is good. My parents love me. These eggs and bacon were great this morning. And I'm just going to beat the crap out of that
right.
nerdlinger. You know,
good
like,
point.
Nobody. No, it's just like, you know, if you have a crappy boss, I'm sure they don't wake up and go, man, my wife is beautiful and loves me. And we have sex all the time. And I'm going to go make my employee's life hell. And I'm paid great. And I'm just going to tell him he's crap all day
yeah.
long. You know, it just isn't. That's not the way life is, you know. So I don't, you know, to get off that tangent, but, you know,
yes.
I've been very fortunate because, in a way, a lot of those people have come out of the woodworks to apologize or to say nice things because I have a very public job
mm-hmm.
and it's made me accessible.
Right.
To where they'll be like, holy crap. That,
I knew that,
that
kid.
He's in the newspaper. And
ooh,
then they type
didn't
me into
I
Facebook.
Shove him in the toilet? Maybe I should.
I would, a serious story. I would not use the bathroom in high school because I was too afraid of getting cornered there. Because at least in the hallway, you could scream for help.
Right.
So, no joke.
Yeah,
I would not understand.
Okay. Got
so,
yeah.
but I hope my mother doesn't listen to this because I kept her insulated for most of that. You know, like, but that all played into me wanting to
mm-hmm.
create movies because, if you'd asked me, you know, when I was like 13 years old, like, who's your best friend? I might have said like Nightmare on Elm Street 4.
Right.
Like, you know, like, because I would watch that movie anytime I was feeling down. You know,
mm-hmm.
Every weekend was we could afford to rent maybe two movies. So I would watch the same movies that I owned, a couple tapes I owned. I'd watch them over and over
is
and
that
over.
Dream Warriors? Was it four?
No, that's the next one, Dream Master.
Oh, okay.
That's the one with that Rennie Harlan did with Alice, you know, the one who gains the powers.
Mm, okay.
That was a really light one.
Been too long. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it was super. That was a light one, so I could watch it over. I had all of them.
Gotcha.
But I could only watch one if I wasn't too scared. And
yeah.
I could watch two, but that was still pretty scary. And three was fun, but still scary. Four was mostly laughs, so I could watch
Well, would you say that your experience as a child, and, you know, a little bit like you were saying, where the, you know, the bullies bully or what, or the bullies are the ones that are bullied and they're looking for the outlets or whatever. Would you say you're kind of, you were drawn to, like, the horror? You said you went to the Blockbuster and you picked just all the horror movies and everything. Was that sort of just where, how you channeled, instead of putting it out on somebody else, you decided was horror kind of like an outlet for you in that case?
I never thought about that. Maybe.
You know, maybe instead of you exercising these demons that were being thrust on you by other people, I was just thinking, well, instead of moving it along, I'll just go watch this movie and I'll just watch all these other people have the demons.
That could be. And, you know, and I always thought about why I liked horror movies. And one of the reasons definitely was that when something's morbid, when something's scary, when something's gross, whatever, it's really strong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really easy to escape. You know, because I always think about when people say, like, oh, horror movies are escapism prime. I'm always like, why are they escapism prime? It's because they really grab you in a very specific way. Because as I got older, I started to love every type of movie, and that's
okay.
The way I am now, I'm just obsessed with all movies. I can't get enough comedies, can't get enough dramas, I can't get enough anything that has a good story to tell. I just
mm-hmm.
want to watch it. I want to consume it desperately. So, but as a kid, there were a lot of reasons to like horror movies. One was that they were just kind of cool too, because there was a community. You could read Fango and there were people who loved horror movies. You know, I always, often tell people, like, when people say, like, why do you think horror has such fandom, I'm like, most horror movie fans I know are movie fans. It's just
right.
there's no romantic comedy con, you know,
right.
to
yeah.
go to, but there's the horror movie conventions and the science fiction conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's why, you know, disenfranchised people are attracted to science fiction and horror, is because there's a community. So it's like, we love movies and there's a community. well, then it's the perfect. I mean, because I remember, you know, before MySpace, it would be, it was, I mean, you literally read Fangoria.com and you'd be like, Sleepaway Camp box set. I've never even heard of that movie. It's only $25 for three movies. Mom, you know, I gotta get to Best Buy right now. They might sell out. And then you get there and there's like 15 of them. And
yeah,
you're like,
yeah,
oh exactly. My God, I got one, you know? So it, you know, it helped that the fandom really helped, mm-hmm. you know, especially, and when you're a kid, like Leonard Maltin's movie guide is too dry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't sit and read Leonard Maltin's movie guide, but you can read Joe Bob's at the drive-in because it'll make you laugh and it'll talk about boobs. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff you want when you're, you know, you're going through puberty. You mm-hmm. know, you want that kind of thing. So, I mean, I remember that a lot. I remember the community. And then doing my first horror convention when I was like 13, 14, going to my first horror conventions and seeing that community, that was the only time I ever felt like I belonged anywhere. So I think that definitely fed into it too, because I would start watching every horror movie I could get my hands on. So it is interesting, though. I never thought about that, like that maybe having a dark life, you know, in a way kind of like encourages you. But it definitely makes sense. I mean, most horror fans have been bullied. Most horror movie actors mm-hmm. have been bullied. I mean, if you...
I was just thinking, it's a way you can watch all these things getting played out for you rather than you actually acting on them or acting on anything yourself. It's
cathartic, like, you know, to, mm-hmm. especially like, I mean, if you read about, like, I don't know if you saw Kane Hodder's documentary yet. Mm-hmm. It's excellent. To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story.
No, I have not.
You really give it a watch. You know, he was very bullied as a kid. And then he, you know, ends up playing these like weird, scary underdog characters in a way. And mm-hmm. Derek Mears was the same way, the guy who played Jason in the remake, but he's also been in a ton of movies and TV shows, and he's a really funny guy. And he was bullied a lot. He was a weird looking kid. And you know, I mean, being bullied, you know, one thing that I can tell you for a fact that being bullied does is it makes you want validation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, my friend, is all it takes to drag your butt into show business.
Yeah.
Is if you're like, man, I wish I got more hugs. I'm gonna make a movie and then everyone will hug me, you know.
Yeah, what you're saying is just sort of like an exaggerated version of why you get into podcasting. It's kind of the same. Yeah. It's a little bit of the same thing. Yeah, you're looking for the community, you're looking for the, oh my God, someone listened.
Yeah. We all want to connect. You know, human beings, we all want to connect. It's just the level, I guess, for lack of a better term, of desperation you have, you know, because, you know, somebody once told me or said to me something like, because, I mean, this is audio medium, so people may not know. I dress like a maniac every single day. I just wear as many colors as I can. My pants right now have pink flamingos on them, you know. when people I had one person say, like, you just dress like that to get attention. And I went, whoa, you blew my mind. I had
really?
No clue people had eyes. No, I want people to look at me. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I go out in public with my mother, she'll get really mad that people stare at me. And I have to tell my mom, like, Mom, it's not like this happened to me in an accident.
Yeah, this isn't some horrible birth something.
Tragic
or
chemical spill.
This is I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt. Yes.
I'm wearing clothing and I have a mustache. You know, a pointy mustache, pointy beard. Like, I want people to notice me mm-hmm. where I go. And that's my business. You know, I want to. And so it's always funny when people are like, you know, doesn't it bother you that people, I'm like, I could dress normal anytime I want and stop it. That was the way it was in high school too, is, you know, I knew every day. I was like, if I just stopped, if I cut my hair and did this and this, it would stop. But I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness I was such a vicious narcissist as a child, right?
Well, and I'm kind of... It took me a little longer to reach that point, but I think I did. And it was thanks to a convention kind of thing where, you know, I was I went through school. I tried to be myself, but then, of course, was bullied for it and everything. And so after high school, you get a chance to sort of start fresh, you know, when you get your first job or something like that. You have this whole nother life. And it's, but you kind of like, well, I was myself in high school, so this time I'm going to be a little bit more, you know, quote unquote normal. I'm using the air quotes here on audio. Eventually though, you get bored of that. And it was really when I went to my first real sci-fi convention. I mean, not the old creation cons that used to blow in the town and, mm-hmm. But a real like big family owned con. It was huge. And there was all these people and suddenly there was families.
Yeah.
I've told this story before. This was a life changing moment for me. and there's families, there's friends, there's husbands and wives and girlfriends and boys, and they're all together and they're all having fun, and there's people of all creeds and sizes, and no one cared. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, that she's dressed as a predator, and yes, maybe she's got, you know, things coming out that shouldn't, but you know, no one says is making fun of her. They're going over like, great job on your costume. I'm like, yeah. Like, crap, this is the way the world is supposed to be. I was right all along before. And that was kind of like, well, from this point on, this is like, this is me, yeah. You know, so I'm going to wear the t-shirts. I'm going to wear the camp shirts, whatever. And it's like, and I'm going to treat everyone the way I want them to treat me. And that, you know, hey, I like the shirt. The color is good on you. It doesn't matter that it's, you know, maybe it's anyone else would be an ugly shirt, but you know, you rock it kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and that was, you know, the big thing that was looming over me, because I mentioned having like a lot of older friends. Unfortunately, a lot of them were very jaded. You know, they would be like 25, maybe 30, and they didn't like their jobs. They didn't like their lives. And I had my pie in the sky. Like, I never really thought I would make movies for a living necessarily. I just thought I would get some kind of job in relation to it, hopefully someday. And they would always, their attitude, this would be the attitude of the faculty at school, this was the attitude of, like, some of my older friends, they would always say, like, well, when you get out into the real world, you'll see. And you know what happened? The real world was friggin' boss, it was nothing like high school, and in the real world, people love when you are yourself.
Yes.
Because in the real world, people have met tons of phonies, and they want to meet somebody legit. And that was the funny thing, because doing the conventions and stuff, I was in, I mean, I was, you know, other kids were, you know, staying at home and whatever. And I was going to Baltimore for Horror Find, and I was going to, Chicago for Flashback Weekend, and I was going to Cleveland for Cinema Wasteland, and I was going all these places, going to Pittsburgh for Genghis Khan and all these shows, and meeting tons of different people. And I was like, this has to be the real world, because I'm going places. And like along the way, I'm meeting people not at the shows who are super nice, who are, you know, they want to compliment me. They want to say something nice. You know, they want to ask where I'm headed. What, you know, so it was so funny, because I would always get threatened with like, when you get into the real world, the real world's been totally boss. Like, and I've had my ups and downs. Always been better than high school.
Yeah.
I remember when I was told, like, these are the best years of your life. I was like, I want to.
I hope
they don't still say that to people.
No, I hope not. When you're making your backyard films and everything, and you know, especially some of the early stuff, like you're gonna find on this the Backyard Legacy that you've just released on Blu-ray, is that right?
Backyard Legacy.
Yeah, make sure I got the name right. So I assumed you had just friends that would help, that you just had a kind of a natural, already in place support and everything.
It started to happen.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, where did these people come from? Where did you find the people that would give you the time and the effort that you really wanted to try to actually make something, and not just, you know, ha, I'm on a movie. Ha ha.
Yeah.
You know, if you understand what I mean.
Oh, I totally do.
That would take it seriously, I guess, would be the.
So middle school was the bad times.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, similar to the whole when you get into the real world, is that in high school there was a sect of the community that really dug that I was, you know, out there and that I was doing what I wanted to do. So then I started making some friends, and I would be like, hey, who wants to, you know, go be in my backyard? I'm going to throw some corn syrup at you. And most of those backyard movies, they didn't have scripts or anything, because it was literally when the people showed up, I'd be like, okay, so you're a demon. Let's put some black makeup on your face. Okay, you have a knife. You're going to be chased. Like, it would be whoever showed up. But every time I did one, everybody had a blast. And when you watch them, you can tell, like, hey, they did not have a script. They did not know where they were going with this.
Well, the one, and I'm looking forward to watching on the Blu-ray, because I'm going to watch the other ones. The one I've seen, one of your earliest ones, is the Marty Jenkins.
Oh, yeah, the first feature.
Is that your first feature film?
Yeah, my first feature, I count it as my first feature length. Because before that, like, everything was backyard. Like, that movie had no scenes in my backyard. Like, that movie, I actually went some places. I could drive a car, you know.
Well, okay, yeah. Because I remember the first time I watched it, I bought it from you. And then, like, it took me, like, a year before I finally, or two, maybe, before I finally put it in and watched it. And I sat there, and almost immediately, it's like, oh, my God, this is one of the most fun things I've ever watched. And I started just posting about it on Facebook, and you were were, I was like, oh my God, it's Henrik. It looks like a kid. You're like, I was 17 or whatever.
I was barely 18. I just turned 18. Yeah.
Yeah. Literally we're just a kid, and it was all these, you had all these people that are in there. It just seemed like everyone was just having fun. And you could tell, yes, it was just last of the minute. I mean, everyone, it was at a video store, mm-hmm. where a lot of the stuff took place, and everyone kept walking up with like the same three tapes.
That was I thought it was discs. Hilarious. I yeah. wanted the movie Hobgoblins to be
yes,
on the top
that was
of
the one.
Everything.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it just felt like, okay, here, do that and just hang on to these. And so every time they needed a scene with someone at the counter, there you go. Take that.
Oh, I went out of my way to make sure Hobgoblins was on the top of every single every time. I would actually, the owner who was kind enough to let us film after hours, I would literally go, where's Hobgoblins? And he'd go find it. Because I was like, no, Hobgoblins is on the top of every stack of movies. I just thought it was funny. I don't know exactly why.
It was hysterical. I just remember that being one of my comments, is like, Hobgoblins was a very popular rental.
Yeah, we had a joke if we ever did a sequel that there was going to be a rack that was nothing
but Hobgoblins. Just a section.
Yeah, the Hobgoblins section. And it would be like nearly empty. Like there'd be like six copies left.
Everyone's
we're down to
it.
Six copies. We might want to order more.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my first feature. So actually, when you see on the Backyard Legacy, it says over 6 hours of stuff. The 6 hours is the stuff pre Marty Jenkins. Marty Jenkins
Excellent.
Isn't even included in the 6 hours. So it's actually nine-ish hours when you include Marty Jenkins.
Nice.
And I put Marty Jenkins in there for context. Mm-hmm. So you could see, like, here's all the stuff. Like, here's me 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. And now here's me making my first movie that I considered my first real feature movie. So that you could have like that context kind of build up. Cause I mean, it is quite a marathon. I mean, it's six, Horror Fuel, they did a review of it, and I could not believe how quick the reviewer, there's a friend of mine named Dan Wilder. I could not believe how quickly he munched through 9 hours of stuff. Some of which I would wholly say is a little bit tough to get through, but that's why it's you know, it's over 6 hours. It's quantity over quality, folks. So it's definitely a collector's thing. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I do think I did intros before each one where I sat and talked.
That's nice.
And they tend to be like, I was surprised how much I had to say about the movie. So some of them are like 5 minutes long of just, I talk about what it was like making the movie, what it's like making movies in general. So I almost think it's like a must have if you want to make movies, because just those interviews or intros, I guess is what they really are just really interesting to hear about, like how, you know, if you're like, I don't know if I can make a movie, I don't know what I'm doing. It's like, want to see how I didn't know what I was doing?
Right.
'Cause I didn't know what I was doing. And it was painful to not go in and like spruce those movies up, cut them a little shorter, cut out some stuff that was really bad. I left them as is.
Warts and all, here it is.
I did. I mean, I didn't. The stuff I did when I was 12, I made a mashup because I could not bear sitting through it. It was just too rough. But I left them warts and all the way they were. And that's why I included Marty Jenkins, because it was like, so you could see, like, look, you can start literally in the backyard with two friends and you throw a cup of blood in their face and you can see how annoyed they are. And then in 6 years time, you're 18 and you're making a movie with a coherent plot, with actors that are not too bad. You know, some of them are pretty darn good.
Sure.
And make a movie that has some staying power. And that's one crazy thing about Marty Jenkins, is it has an awful lot of staying power. I think it's because the script happened to be really personal. And I didn't know at the time. I just was kind of writing whatever came to me, but it happened to be really personal. I was going through a really nasty breakup, and I put a lot of like the vitriol in there. And I think that's what made that movie, you know, hold up, was that it had that real edge to it.
Well, I finally threw it in just because, like, okay, you know, where did he come from was how I was thinking. So I wanted to watch it, and I was amazed at just how much fun it was. I was expecting it to be a lot more rough.
Yeah.
Probably like a little bit like what I'm going to find
on Backyard Legacy.
Backyard Legacy.
You're gonna find that.
Yeah. I was expecting it to be a much more rough, and it's like, it's still fun. Yes, it is obviously done with just step up from Backyard.
Yeah,
it's definitely amateur filmmaking, you know, and micro budget kind of thing, or no budget, you know.
I would say, yeah, no budget is a fair assessment.
Yeah, the lost money budget. Yeah. Negative budget. And that's obvious, but it's still just like, it's just so much fun, because there's a lot of heart and the people were taking it seriously
and we had so much fun.
That comes through, and I think that's what helps make it fun, is that you can see everyone else had a lot of fun
And I mean, I still like that movie quite a bit. I haven't sat and watched it in a while. I said I would to myself, but you know, I got other stuff to do right now. But
I'm not mistaken.
Wanna.
Was that also, didn't you have like as a special feature, you actually had the premiere of the film? Yeah, you did some video of the premiere, which I think the premiere was actually in that video store, wasn't it? Yeah.
Now that was before I had the clout to try and get a movie theater and I had no money. So the movie, I was lucked out. I had a buddy who is, I think he still is. He was the head of AV at a major corporation in the area. I don't want to mention it because he used their equipment.
Sure.
But he's head of AV. So he was like, I can get you a screen and a projector. Just find a place with chairs. So and the guy who owned Precinct 13 Video at the time was kind enough to actually – he ate the cost of renting the chairs.
Nice.
And he let me keep all the money from the door. He was very – I mean, I wrote half that script sitting on the couch at that store. Like, I used to live at that store. There was a Quiznos next door. I lived there. I lived there. I would eat lunch and dinner there. You know, nice. I should have just worked there, but he couldn't afford an employee. but I would like watch the place when he went to the bathroom. I'd just stand there. We held the premiere there. I think we had like 50 chairs and we filled almost all of them, which was really cool. And that premiere video is great because I'm so nervous.
Yes, you are.
Terrified of that people aren't going to think the movie's funny.
You think the white balance is off. Like, nope, that's just the way it looks. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I was nervous.
Does he still have green makeup on? No, he's probably sick.
There was a period. It's finally over. There was a period where during premieres, I would vomit. I would go vomit in the bathroom. Mm. I've gotten over that for the most part. I almost vomited at the premiere of Nothing Good Ever Happens. I just could not handle how personal that movie was. I was not ready for people to – anybody disliked it. It was just gonna kill me. So I went to the bathroom. I was like, almost. And I was like, oh, it's fine. Go get a Diet Coke and just try to chill out.
Well, this has been fun. I mean, the first film that I got a chance to watch of yours, it was an official screening and went to the screening, was Babysitter Massacre.
Yes.
And that was the first time. That was the first film, and
that's a great movie with a crowd.
It was a lot of fun because everyone laughs at the right time and claps at the right time. It is a good crowd film. And then I've definitely, if I haven't been able to make the screen, I try to make as many as I can. But I'll try to, when you do the Kickstarters or the crowdsourcing or whatever, I'll throw what I can. I've been following your career and then watching you progress and evolve as a filmmaker, and that's one of the things that I really enjoy, and probably why I had so much fun watching Marty Jenkins is now I've seen him kind of like on both ends. I've seen you grow as a filmmaker, and it's like every film you learn a little something new and you use that, which is great. I really appreciate of following your career and appreciate your work is like, maybe that one's not the best, it's okay, but he's going to take something from that. And the next film, is going to be an improvement on it. And that's been a lot of fun to watch.
Thank you. You know, I have a lot of belief that, like, if you don't learn something new every movie, you're even – because 16 features. The 16th one is a movie called Haunting Inside, which will be premiering later this year. I haven't announced it exactly yet, but it's coming.
Great.
And I'm very excited about it. It got held up in post-production. It's a long story, boring story, but it just got held up. And but it's a cool ghost story. But like, no joke, like when we were making that movie, there was a scene that required pasta, like for the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Walmart and I bought like a pasta you bake yourself. And I was like, you know what? Like, we'll just eat this for lunch because we're baking it anyway. I baked it. We ate it. Everybody loved it. And then I realized how cheap it was. And I was like, holy crap. From now on, if we're on a location with an oven, I'm doing this. And I was like, 16 films and I'm still figuring out how to do it better. because that's the other thing that a lot of people forget. I mean, know how to compose a shot, know how to pick a lens, know how to set up a light, but like, you also have to know how to feed people, you have to know how to keep them happy, you have to know how to not overwork the right people. I got to recently work with Brink Stevens, and we were working, and it was amazing, but we were working in a cold environment and we were working overnights, and you have to think like, how much energy does Brink reasonably have, and how much is it respectful to expect,
right?
More so, because Brink will walk through fire to do a good job. But then you have to think, but is it worth her walking through fire, or can I just do a better job on my end?
Right.
So you always have to be thinking about those kinds of things. So it's just funny, though. I remember thinking, like, 16th movie, I just learned how to feed people way better and cheaper. better and cheaper. You don't often get both of those at the same time. Because I was literally like, this is cheaper than sandwiches, and it can be a hot lunch. Yeah. Double thumbs up, you know. So there's always something to learn.
Well, as well as evolving, I like that you're not afraid to experiment a little bit. I mean, you obviously started with a lot of horror and everything, but you've thrown in, you started with maybe, I'd say it's a natural progression. If you're going to try something different, you go for maybe the dark comedy,
mm-hmm.
which I think you did. But then, I mean, you go and you do something like Bulldog for Christmas. It's a full-on family film.
Yeah.
And this is great. I mean, that's a great. That was another screening I got a chance to see, and
I still love that movie.
It's a fun film,
and it has no cynicism. That was the big thing I told people is I was like, I'm not going to go into this going like, yes, I'm making a Christmas movie. I was like, I am making this Christmas movie, and you're going to watch it with your kids, and that's all there is.
It's perfectly fine for a family and for young kids and everything. There is nothing in there, you know, objectionable or anything, and it's like it's fantastic. And then go after that, and you're like, you know what, I'll make a Western.
Yeah.
And so you make a Western, and it's like, God, I love this, you know. It's just,
well, and it's fun. And you know, the secret is you just have to find the story you like, want to tell, that you like,
mm-hmm.
in any of those things, and then you're done. You know, Bulldog for Christmas was actually a very personal movie at the time. I just went through a very personal loss, so I was like, you know what, it can be a family Christmas movie about a family dealing with loss, because what would create strife in a family? Loss creates strife in a family.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. So I was able to really like exercise that. With the Western, I really wanted feminist overtones, because mm-hmm. I knew when I was going to make a Western, I was like, the only way I'm going to make a Western is if Aaron Ryan is the lead. So Aaron Ryan is Calamity Jane.
Yes.
But I remember, you know, and I was like, you know what I really want to tell? I want to tell a story about revenge, but the only revenge stories I like are the ones where you realize how empty revenge is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Star Trek lover.
Sure.
So clearly that's where we were going. So that was like my whole thing. I was like, okay, vengeance story, but a moral tale, a morality mm-hmm. tale. So I loved making that one. And I love all the straight comedies I've made, all the drama comedies, all the weird comedies, stuff like that. I hope to tackle science fiction soon.
That just popped in my head, and I'm thinking, boy, that's quite the leap.
I'll tell you something right now. I got a script.
Yeah? Wow.
I got a sci-fi script. It's just a matter of finding the right time to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very high concept, but it's doable. So it's just a matter of time before that puppy gets made.
At the least, though, I mean, what's awesome about science fiction is a lot of time when you say science fiction, people immediately go to spaceships and lasers, mm-hmm. and you don't necessarily need that for science fiction.
Especially, we've had a really interesting science fiction renaissance where it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh gosh, like, did you see Her?
No.
The one where the guy falls in love with basically
Siri. Oh, right, with his phone.
It's an amazing movie. Yeah. But it's just a slightly more advanced technological society where mm-hmm. it happens. Computers happen to be better at talking to you. Or like there was that movie that just came out, Sorry to Bother You, which is about a telemarketer. But it takes place just a little bit in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the sci-fi elements reveal themselves, but it's a story about a lot of things. We have a lot of that where it's just kind of a soft little, it's a little mm-hmm. bit into the future, but it's mostly about people, but there is some tech that doesn't exist yet and stuff.
Right.
And I really love those areas. Now, that being said, the one I have is in a spaceship.
Nice. All right.
Oh, I was like, this has got to be in space.
Yeah. You're going to do it. Space. Yeah. Jump in the deep end and let's see who can swim. Yeah.
So, and we got a script and it's good. It was written by one of my constant collaborators
mm-hmm.
and I'm very proud of it. It's just a matter of time. It really is. It's just a matter of time.
Now let's talk. You mentioned her name, Aaron Ryan. I wanted to mention some of what you would be considered like, you know, your stable of actors, some of your go tos and everything that have turned up in many of your films. Aaron R. Ryan is probably, has she been in the most? Is that
if not the most, very close?
Mm-hmm.
We once had a count. We must have done 8 movies together, maybe 9, maybe. So I mean, I met Aaron on my 5th feature. And she's been in almost every movie.
Yeah.
With a few exceptions. So, yeah, I mean, she's probably my most constant collaborator. Maybe Joni Durian, they might be like right neck and neck.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that was another, was probably the second one that on my head when I think of like who's been in his movies. Aaron Ryan, Joni Durian.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm working with her in like a week.
Awesome.
So we're shooting a bunch of stuff. I've been in a marathon
yeah.
Production that I can't talk about, unfortunately. but it's been a marathon, and I'm not used to that. I'm used to movie done, and this one has been
understood. So is it kind of one of these things where you find someone and you work with, and he's like, okay, that worked really well. Could you come back and do it again? Or do they come like, when's your next? I'd like to work with you again. Is it a little bit of both? Mary Lee Osborne is another name. Yeah, I mean, she was in a Babysitter Massacre.
And a Bulldog for Christmas. Awkward Thanksgiving. Nothing good ever happens. You know, it's a combo. I mean, if I like working with somebody, then I'm going to work with them again. I mean, if you have a good attitude, you are a real asset to the movie, mm-hmm. or the project, because if you have a good attitude, it's infectious. It'll make the crew happy and excited, even if they're tired and hungry or cold. If you have a happy personality, easy to get along with, you're going to make friends on the set, you know, so you're going to have a good time. They're going to have a good time, because at the end of the shoot, you're working with friends. Yeah. You're not working with crew.
If they bring the energy, other mm-hmm. people are going to feed off of that energy.
Oh yeah.
And right back at you, and you get a nice,
I've actually had shoots where we had like really intensive scheduling issues, or we had really intensive whatever going on. And I've actually asked Erin Ryan to be on set as just general support, like as my assistant.
Oh, nice.
Because she's so helpful and mm-hmm. has such a great energy. We did that on Scarewaves. We had one segment in Scarewaves that was really hard to shoot. And I was like, are you free that night? Could you come and just help me personally? Like, and she did. She just followed me around and did whatever needed to be done that was specifically for me. And part of it was just, it's nice to look over and know Erin's there, and she's there to help me. She's a good person, a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a big part of the battle. You know, if you're really talented and you're a prick, I don't really want to work with you. Like, you have to be pretty talented and ideally famous, because otherwise, who cares if it's you or someone else, you know? Right. So I often tell people that, I'm like, to some extent, like, how nice you are, how easy you are to deal with is more important than your talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's true, not just in no budget cinema, but in most any job. You know, there's this saying, a friend of mine, he's a drummer for a living. And he says that it can either pay really good, be with great people, or be great material. If it's two of those things, you're in. You know,
exactly.
It's never perfect. All three, though.
No,
the money's great, the material's great, the people stink.
Unfortunately, maybe someday. You did mention Scarewaves. I wanted to mention that one because
you were on set.
I did. I got to be on set for a couple nights on Scarewaves. Yeah. So two different segments. That's an anthology film.
Oh my gosh, were you on set? You were on set. I know you were on set when for the guy, the crook that gets shot.
Yes.
Because you held the tree branch.
I held the tree branch in the light, yes. I was tree, yes.
And what was the other day you were there?
I was there when you were shooting the one with the, with Joni Durian.
Oh, okay, and Titus Wolverton.
And Titus Wolverton, and, yes. Uh-huh.
Oh, okay, I thought you might have been there, but my mind was kind of blanking on it for a second. Because I really remember...
John Dalton's segment. He wrote that one.
Mm-hmm. I really remember how... like amusing it was for everybody, but you especially, when I just handed you, I ran off and broke a tree branch off and handed it to you. I was like, do this, and you were like, hey, that works really. You were really surprised that it like sold the idea of Moonlight.
It did. It was awesome. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you letting me kind of come out and hang out and you know, help. I like carried a couple cables or something.
You were helped.
It was a lot of fun, and to see a lot of the kind of the behind the scenes and see how it, you know, see the nitty gritty. It's amazing how much of sort of downtime to set up, and then you get maybe a few minutes of shot, and then it's time to set up somewhere. And it was a long night, and it was so much fun.
And we move fast. I mean, our productions have to move pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So it's, I mean, you know, a lot of these movies only get like 5 days total, you know, 4 days, 5 days. 4 days is tough, but we've done it.
But being on that set and seeing behind the scenes, and then get a chance to go to the screening and see the finished product and everything. And that is maybe, I hate to say my favorite of your films, mm-hmm. but I think it was the one that's kind of my good. If I was going to say, oh, I want you to watch a Henrik Kudo film, I think Scarewaves is the one I might give them to watch.
Well, it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun.
It gives you lots of flavors.
Exactly.
It's Neapolitan ice cream.
Because it's the anthology, it's got a little bit of something for everybody in there. It's got a lot of the actors that you've worked mm-hmm. with are in different segments and everything. So, yeah, it seems to be for me, it would be kind of like the go-to, like, watch this one, and then if you like it, you know, then we can branch out a little bit.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I remember when Scarewaves ended, because I've done, not only have I done a lot of horror movies, but I've done a lot of varying degrees of horror. You know, Babysitter Massacre is like a thrill ride kind of slasher. And then like Haunted House of Sorority Row is this kind of like cold, dark, creepy thing. And Scarewaves was, you know, was all comic booky. And it, you were allowed to go like, which you don't get to do with a lot of movies. And it's hard to make a horror movie for me anyway. So when I remember when the Scarewaves has its last twist at the end, and then that Scarewaves theme song played by the Loveless, who are amazing, who did that song just for us. You know, when that plays and everyone goes whistles and claps, like,
I remember
that. That's a good time right there, my friends. That's a good time.
I think it's just it's just for me, it just seems like the good gateway. Because like you said, because it's a little bit more of a, I'm trying to think of the word. It's just all-encompassing, I guess. It's there is a word that perfectly describes what I'm trying to think of, but I can't think of that word.
You get dark, and creepy segments. Mm-hmm. You get funny segments. Because the one I wrote was very humorous. But then the one with the security guard alone in the building is really dark and creepy.
Yes.
And then the one with the painting artist who sacrifices models to a demon, that one is like kind of spooky, but it's not super dark. And then the one with the two crooks and everything is very just straight up Tales from the Crypt. It's just everything. It's
Tales from the Crypt might be, I was thinking Twilight Zone, but really Tales of the Crypt would probably be the better.
Well, I like to believe that every segment was like from a different anthology, of a vein of a different anthology. I felt like the Painting After Midnight one was like, Are You Afraid of the Dark? But with boobs and butts. And then the one with the two crooks was very much my Tales from the Crypt.
Mm-hmm.
And then my security guard one was really dark, where he's haunted by all the people he shot that he may not have been justified in killing. I thought that one was my Tales from the Hood. Like, I went because I loved how dark Tales from the Hood was. Like, it really didn't let you feel good about it, you know? And then my final one, the one about the girl who's going crazy waiting to find out if her lover kills his girlfriend, that one I felt like was more of a creep show, because creep show always had that like really boing 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 kind of goofiness to
right.
it, and that one is really goofy. And I wrote that one, so I know how goofy it was going to be from the moment I started working on it. The biggest laugh on that one, by the way, is when she keeps falling asleep and not realizing it. So she has like that moment where she wakes up sitting on the couch and realizes, you know, she was asleep, but then the second time it happens, she wakes up and she's on the toilet. Always gets a huge laugh from people.
Bathrooms are funny. You can't help it.
So I'm just thinking about how she's just, and then she like looks around and then she just starts grabbing the toilet paper and it cuts to
No, it's definitely a film for everyone to check out. And am I wrong that a lot of these films are now, they're on Amazon Prime, aren't they?
A huge amount of them are. Scarewaves is on Amazon Prime. Haunted House and Sorority Rose on Amazon Prime. Most of my comedies are on there. Awkward Thanksgiving, Nothing Good Ever Happens, Making Out, Calamity Jane's Revenge. A lot of them are. Babysitter Massacre was, but it isn't currently, but it'll probably be back up soon. It long story with distributor changes.
Gotcha,
and stuff.
Sure.
But that one got its huge, relatively huge cult following because it was on Amazon Prime really early in Amazon Prime's history. So it has 115 reviews. It got a lot of play. And it was the last independent movie ever on the shelves of Blockbuster.
Was it?
Babysitter Massacre.
Interesting. Nice.
So
cool.
That was a nice little last second
little
bucket
place
list.
Place of history. Yeah.
Yeah, I lucked out. We've had a good chance to get a lot of those out, and you know, your listeners are welcome to, I mean, they'll never spell my name for the life of them, but if they copy and paste from your show notes,
yes,
they can just paste it into Amazon. You'll find all kinds of stuff I've been involved with.
And I definitely recommend checking them out, because I mean, if you're a fan of independent film, which I've grown to be once I discovered it, kind of thing, and I realized the heart and the effort that goes in by so few to produce, you know, a movie. It's very hard. Not all the movies of any director or any producer or filmmaker, I'll just say filmmaker, are great. Sometimes, you know, everyone has their missteps and everything, and not all of them are for everybody. But I, as someone once told me when they were talking about it, I was like, you know, it's really hard to even make a bad movie.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate the effort that goes into any film, even if it's one that I'll watch and I'll go, oh, well, all right, you know, that was a movie, you know. But I love the effort. I love the heart that you've put into the films and that comes through in the film. I never feel like you or anyone on the camera is just phoning it in.
Thank you.
And that is honest. I'm not saying it because I'm here in front of you.
but I really do appreciate that. You know, if you want, I can tell you something really candid about that. Amityville: No Escape. I consider it to be one of my scariest, creepiest movies. Have you seen that one?
I have not seen it yet.
You really, you should definitely check it out. It's on Prime. I would give it a watch.
When I stumbled on it, it was kind of one of these things. I've turned on Prime, and it was kind of like, oh, you might like, because of some recommendation. I was like, wait a minute, I know that movie. And so I searched your name because I do know how to spell it. And yeah, I saw these ones like, oh, these are the ones I haven't had a chance to see yet. So I got really excited. So yeah, a bunch of them are on my playlist.
Give it a shot. It's short. You know, it's like 75 minutes. I think it might be my creepiest movie that I've done.
Nice.
And when I shot it, it had problems. And when we had it edited together, it was 71 minutes and it just didn't work very well. And I kept looking at it, me and my editor, Eric Whiting, we kept looking at it and we were like, I was like, Eric, what do you think? There's like 50 minutes of good stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, probably like 50 minutes. And, you've met him. So, you know, that's how he sounds.
I was going to say, that's actually a pretty good impression. Yeah.
So I told him, one
can truly do Eric, well, but yeah.
But so I told him, I was like, well, what we need to do is what are we going to do? Was my response. But then I also, and I'm being, you know, totally honest, I had my moment where I was like, dude, we shot the movie, we spent the money, I just need to get this movie out into the world and move on, because like it is my job, and sometimes you really are pushed hard. And then we screened Making Out, my romantic comedy. And the audience was losing their mind laughing, and it was a great premiere. It was one of the best for laughter and just sheer jokes hitting and everything. And I remember about halfway through that screening, I was literally like, I got to do something about Amityville. I cannot put it out the way it is, because these people, if these people don't love it, I'm a real piece of crap.
Yeah. Now you don't want to disappoint. Yeah.
Because I owe it to them. And I owe it to myself, because I always said, like, I won't tell a story unless I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's my gift, is I can find something to like in most stories. So I remember it was like the day after, or maybe it was the day after the premiere, I called Eric and I was like, I know what we're going to do. We're going to do a B story that's not related to the main characters. And we're going to cast the best possible actor we can get. Julia Gomez is going to be the entire third of the movie.
She was in the Calamity Jane, right? She was the young girl.
Exactly. And she's amazing.
She absolutely amazing.
And her availability stinks, but we could get her because we shot it on her spring break.
Mm-hmm.
So from college, because she's studying acting. And I was like, because to me, she's a ringer. It's like, okay. So what we did was we had a found footage movie about Amityville, about these kids camping outside of Amityville and being haunted by a ghost. And I was like, every two scenes, we're going to cut to Julia Gomez in 1997. We shot it on an 8mm tape camera.
Nice.
And we're going to let her do a video journal to her husband, who's in the Gulf War, about fixing up this house she's moved into, and it's the Amityville house.
Nice. So,
and creepy stuff is going to
create a little backstory within the story. Nice.
And Julia is so engaging
that
every scene she's in is going to strengthen the entire picture.
Oh.
And by adding the 30 minutes of Julia, we were able to take out everything that wasn't great about the other segment and make everyone look phenomenal.
Excellent. Now I'm very, yeah.
So we busted our butts. We shot that. We cut it in, and then I remember sitting there watching the movie going, like, this works. And the craziest part was I reached out to a buddy of mine at foundfootagefilms.com, I believe is the name of the website. But they're dedicated to found footage movies. They love them.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him about it, and I was like, has anyone ever done that before, where they leaped back in time and, they have two stories running simultaneously and one is in the past? And he was like, no. He was like, there's one where it goes into the past, but not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, really? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, So we did something original. Oh my God. Like, I never in a million years could have ever hoped to do something original. So
that's awesome.
So, but I remember being so proud, you know, and it took, I mean, we spent an extra month. And that movie sat in post for a really long time because we had to, mm-hmm. to get it right. But I'm so glad that I didn't let any cynicism fool me. And that's something I don't even think I admitted that in the commentary because I wasn't comfortable enough yet admitting that I almost let a movie come out that I wasn't happy with.
Right.
A similar thing happened with Devil's Trail. We cut that together, and at first it didn't work, but then Eric and I really busted our butt. It was the big problem really was the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Once it had sound and the right sounds, all of a sudden the movie was terrifying, like really scary. So yes. Then it was like, never mind. This is a really scary movie. Cool story. Let's move on. You know, let's turn on all the lights. So, you know, I've fought really hard with that because, you know, I mean, I'm 31 and I've made 16 features.
Mm-hmm.
That is the output of most filmmakers' lifetime.
Yes.
And I don't intend to stop or slow down.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. A lot of people in my life would like me to slow down for just a minute, maybe catch my breath a little bit. The funny thing is people think I'm catching my breath right now, but I've been working on a secret project for like a year.
You always feel like you've got some iron in the fire somewhere.
Well, and I've been producing this year. Mm-hmm. You know, I produced The Girl in the Crawl Space with Jonah Dalton, screenwriter, his directorial debut.
Fantastic.
And then I produced Horn Dog's Beach Party, which unfortunately, due to fights with Amazon, you can stream it on the title Beach Babe Bingo, which I'm very proud of that title. Beach Babe Bingo.
I like it.
But it's a USA Up All Night style raunchy comedy, and I produced another one that's still a secret until this Christmas season. But
nice.
I let you get a sneak peek, and
I did. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
And it's been a really rewarding experience bringing filmmakers' work out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited for John Dalton's because that one I got to be on set, and I was producing on set, and I think it turned out really incredible. I'll say it here. I don't mind. I'm already pushing John to direct another movie. I'm like, dude, let's just do another one. Yeah, that one went oddly smooth. Let's do another one quickly. So, you know, I don't know that I'm going to transition to producing much.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that long secret project I've been talking about, that's tied me up as a director. And I refuse to direct until that's done. So I produced a little bit.
Focus that energy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just love, I love the film business. You know, the film business has been kind to me. I've worked very hard to do okay. So... in a way, it's like, well, then I'll produce something. And, you know, like two of the films I produced, John's and then the other one that's still kind of a secret, they're both first-time directors. And that makes me very excited because, mm-hmm. you know, nobody came to me and said, like, hey, you want to make your first movie?
Right.
I mean, so it was kind of cool to be able to do that, to go and say, like, hey, do you want an excuse to make your first feature film? And I promise you I'll do everything in my power to make as many people watch it as I can because it behooves me financially, you know? So it's been a wild ride. And then we've been doing things like there have been some new things like I put out the Babysitter Massacre limited edition, which mm-hmm. as of right now has maybe 27 copies left. I guess now is the pluggy time. I'll mention.
Yes, now's the time.
If you want to check out, like I said, you can just type my name into Amazon. But if you want to check out my physical media stuff, you can go to henflix.com, henflix.com. That's where The Backyard Legacy is available. That's where the Babysitter Massacre limited edition is available while supplies last. And I can tell you right now, the next limited edition to come out is going to be Alone in the Ghost House.
Oh, nice.
So we haven't announced it officially, but we did the same treatment with Babysitter Massacre. It's got brand new artwork.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you flip it over, you get the original artwork, and it's going to have a behind the scenes documentary that's brand new. So it's going to have some new extras, and it'll be the first time ever presented in high definition on Blu-ray.
Oh, very nice. Good.
It'll
I
be
like
a DVD
one,
combo
so
as
fun.
Well. So
good.
I love doing the combos because that way people can, if they upgrade, you know, if they're like, oh, I have his DVD. It's like, well, next Christmas you might have Blu-ray. So let's just play it safe.
Right.
You know? So, but that'll be the next one. By the time this airs, it probably still won't be announced. So you get a little exclusiveness.
There you go, folks. Yeah, you heard it here.
Yeah. So, and you can hit up, if you go to henflix.com, you can actually sign up. To just be notified anytime a new product is added. So,
excellent.
And we run sales and stuff like that. Because, you know, physical media, while niche and while small, really is a huge benefit to independent filmmakers. If you buy a copy of a movie directly from an independent filmmaker, they're getting a large portion of the money you're spending. And you're spending not more money than you would spend on any other site. So, you know, if you're like, man, I'd love to support, you know, independent filmmakers, you know, go to henflix.com, buy the cheapest thing on there, and you're helping immensely.
There you go.
So, but it,
believe me, independent film is usually the best 10 or 20 or $25 I spend, I think. That's my opinion.
Oh, I'm the same. I buy stuff. I buy indie stuff because I like movies a lot. Gosh, what was it? Did you see The Barn? Have you seen The Barn yet?
No, I have not.
That the Halloween, it's an 80s style movie.
Nice.
I saw that at a screening and I ran out and bought that Blu-ray like on my phone in the lobby. I was like, give me that now. Nice. So I try to buy indie stuff whenever I can. You know, as more, you know, the irony, as more people buy Blu-rays from me, I buy more Blu-rays from it's the trickle down independent cinema.
Yeah, so help Henrik buy more movies
and pay the dog's vet bills. But you know, that's the and pay for the Prius payments. I still got a couple more years of Prius payments. Yes. So, when we made Alone in the Ghost House, my first found footage movie, that was literally a reaction to my car dying. I was like, I have to make a cheap movie now.
So you did it like in like a weekend or something, or like in between.
Basically a weekend. Yeah. It was right after Scarewaves had wrapped because everybody was so pumped. I just brought a bunch of people back from Scarewaves and we used all the props from Scarewaves so that we could do it so cheaply. Yes. But it was literally because I was like, my car is dead and I need to do something that's going to eventually help me with my down payment.
Well, there you go. So you've heard the energy and the spirit that Henrik puts in all his films. You know where you can find his movies. Please go and seek him out. Buy a few. If you know you want to dip your toe and watch him first, Amazon Prime is a great way to do it. But if you like the film, buy the DVD. Because you're going to get a ton of extras. Man, that is what I love about your films. It is not a bare bones movie.
We try to at least give you a commentary.
Yes.
At the very least, commentary, if not a little featurette. That's why this new Alone in the Ghost House has a featurette, because it originally didn't have a featurette. It had some short films and stuff like that, but no featurette. So I was like, all right, this time around, we're going to do it right. And, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that a bunch of my horror releases are going to slowly trickle out in limited edition, but the ones that do, which might be all of them, are going to have featurettes. So
awesome. Nope, I love it. I will continue to follow your work and just, you know, wherever you lead me, I'm gonna follow behind and see what you got going on. So, Henrik, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me tonight. This has been an absolute blast. It's a long time coming. It's just the timing was just perfect because with the release of the early stuff, like I said, this is perfect excuse to talk about the early days.
Sure.
You know, it's always nice to talk about the latest thing you got coming. It's like, well, his latest thing is his oldest thing, so this is perfect.
Well, and reflection is really, it's good for the soul.
Yeah,
I learned that doing this, man, because that's the other thing, those intros like are unrehearsed, unprepared, beyond like I knew what movie I would talk about, and my assistant would say a title, and then I'd be like, roll camera. And then I just kind of go off. So it was really interesting. By the end, I was like, I've learned so much about where I came from. So, and it's always good. You know, you can't forget where you came from, as they say on the street.
Yep. And actually, before I go, just while we're talking about Amazon Prime, even if you don't, if you really want to just really dip a toe, you've got some shorts on there.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a great way to start because your short films are so much fun.
Thank
the
you.
First one was Demon Bed.
Oh, Bed Demon.
Bed Demon, yeah. Sorry. Bed Demon. That is hilarious.
Thank you.
Love that. That's another little thing you threw together with Aaron Ryan, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, my God.
We improvised the whole thing, and then I just edited out the jokes that didn't hit.
That is so brilliant. And you can find that on Amazon Prime. So
yep.
It's like, what, 15 minutes? Not even?
Oh, no, it's 6 minutes.
Six minutes?
Nice and short.
Super short. A lot of fun. That's another thing you do. You know, the few moments that you might have that you're not making a movie, you got music videos, you've got some little short you throw together with one of your actors, you know, you've got the you know, stuff that kind of pops up on YouTube or your Facebook or whatever. It is awesome. It's just the energy that you have and that you just keep pumping it out and keep busy. It's just amazing. That's what's made following you so much fun. I'm so glad for the B movie celebration in 2012.
Me too.
That led me to you and your films, and you know, get the chance to, you know, to call you a friend and follow. It's been an honor. It's just been fun.
Thank you so much. I really sincerely appreciate it.
And I sincerely appreciate you sitting down and spending a good hour of your night doing this for me and chatting. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Anytime you'd like to.
Excellent. All right.
Well, that's it. Told you there was a lot in that talk. A little about a lot might be a good way to describe it. And maybe a lot about a little. We did occasionally fall down a rabbit hole or two. So go to Amazon. Go to henflix.com. You can watch and or buy just about everything we talked about. And watch for news as it is allowed to be shared on the super secret but awesome things coming from Henrik Kudo. Last thing I'll say before letting you go. If not Henrik, then look around where you live. I guarantee you there's a man or a woman with a camera nearby. Support your independent filmmaker. So that's going to do it. Matt and I will be back in studio here next time. We're going to review the film 11 Minutes Ago. It's a little sort of romantic comedy time travel flick. Something I watched years ago and talked to the filmmakers on. I was really curious to get Matt's opinion on it. So it should be pretty exciting. If you've seen it, let us know. Send us an email. Join a Facebook group. There's a conversation waiting to happen there. So that's going to do it. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. Bye.